From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Attorney General Jeff Sessions testified before the House Judiciary Committee today. He said that until he read recent news stories about it, he had no recollection of a meeting last year during which volunteer campaign aide George Papadopoulos mentioned that he'd been in contact with Russians who wanted to set up a meeting with then-candidate Donald Trump.
After reading his account, and to the best of my recollection, I believe that I wanted to make clear to him that he was not authorized to represent the campaign with the Russian government or any other foreign government for that matter. And I would gladly have reported it had I remembered it, because I pushed back.
Sessions has twice before testified that as a Trump campaign advisor, he did not have contacts with Russians and did not know anyone in the campaign who did. Joining us now is NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what kind of tightrope is Sessions walking on these issues?
A small one, Jeremy, because Jeff Sessions all along in three previous appearances under oath in the Senate this year has said, I didn't know or I had no contact with Russians over the course of the campaign about the election. And he's balanced that against his inability to recall certain meetings, like that meeting you mentioned, that March 31st, 2016 meeting of the Trump Foreign Policy Committee, which he chaired, and it was the only meeting that that committee ever had. So he's now landed today in his testimony before the House Judiciary Committee at, I don't remember, I sort of refresh my memory, I don't remember exactly what George Papadopoulos said, but I didn't do anything wrong.
And how did members of Congress react to that?
Well, Republicans very quickly turned the tables and were trying to press the Attorney General Jeff Sessions to announce an investigation of Trump's political opponent, Hillary Clinton, a special counsel there, whereas Democrats said, in ordinary times, we'd have a lot of questions to ask you, Mr. Attorney General, about civil rights, voting rights, violent crime, but these are not ordinary times, and we want to ask you about Russia. So almost all the Democratic questions, led by John Conyers, who's the top Democrat on the committee from Michigan, have focused on Russia and what Sessions knew.
Well, what about that idea of investigating the Clintons? We learned even before this hearing today that Sessions is considering appointing a special counsel to look into Hillary Clinton's emails, the Clinton Foundation, and an Obama-era uranium deal that involved Hillary Clinton. What more do we know about that?
Yeah, in a bit of a surprise, last night on the eve of this hearing, the Justice Department sent a letter to Chairman Bob Goodlatte, a Virginia Republican who leads the House Judiciary Committee, saying that Attorney General Sessions and his deputy had directed senior federal prosecutors to evaluate these Clinton Foundation allegations, allegations against Hillary Clinton, and to recommend eventually whether a special counsel should be appointed or any further action would be taken. Jeff Sessions was pressed for more details today by Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio. Sessions finally said, listen, we need facts here. Looking like something happened that's bad is not enough of a basis to appoint a special counsel. And Sessions says that review is underway. He made no commitments or promises.
And he had said previously that he would recuse himself from anything related to Hillary Clinton.
As part of his confirmation hearing in January to lead the Justice Department, Jeff Sessions announced he would recuse himself from anything related to Hillary Clinton, in part because he had acted as a top surrogate for President Trump during last year's campaign. Sessions didn't really explain how he could somehow be involved in this special counsel determination and be recused from the Russia matter and the Hillary Clinton matters.
Carrie, he also weighed in on Roy Moore, who is running to replace Sessions in the U.S. Senate.
A bit of a surprise, Jeremy. Jeff Sessions said today, I have no reason to doubt the young women who are accusing Roy Moore of sexual abuse or misconduct. But Sessions said that's normally a state matter, not a matter for the U.S. Justice Department. Sessions may be recused if it does get to the U.S. Justice Department, because as you said, that is his old Senate seat. He has friends participating in the campaign, including Republican Luther Strange, who was filling the job on an interim basis.
Right. One more story I want to ask you about, Carrie, and that is that we learned that Donald Trump Jr. had been in contact with WikiLeaks before the election about Democratic Party emails that U.S. intelligence agencies believed were hacked by Russians. Some of the communications between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks came out yesterday. Was there any violation of law there to be communicating with WikiLeaks during the campaign?
That's a subject of ongoing debate among legal scholars, politicians, and perhaps even the special counsel for the Russia probe, Robert Mueller. At this point, we can say that Donald Trump Jr. has acknowledged having some exchanges with WikiLeaks via direct message on Twitter. He describes them and plays them down as sort of inconsequential. Obviously, this presents another data point in the story last year of who in the Trump campaign was in contact with other people trying to dish dirt or have dirt on Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump's opponent. Certainly something that congressional committees will be looking at and the special counsel, Robert Mueller, as well.
That's NPR Justice Department correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, we've appropriately been hearing quite a bit from Puerto Rico, the U.S. territory decimated by Hurricane Maria. What about another one, the U.S. Virgin Islands, St. Thomas, St. John, St. Croix? More than 33,000 people there are waiting for help from FEMA, more than a third of the American territory's population. And 2 months after Hurricanes Irma and Maria, 73% of Virgin Island residents are without power. USA Today reporter Frederica Scouten just returned to Washington from St. Croix, where she grew up, and much of her family still lives and had terrible property damage. Frederica, what was it like going there?
It is pretty devastating. I first had a sense of it from the air. The line of beaches along Frederickstead, which is the town where I was born, just pounded clean of sand, just stone left from the storm surge. And then as we got closer and sort of turned to make our landing, I started to see the blue tarps covering scores and scores of homes on the southwest corner of the island. Very difficult to see.
Well, and you meet a lot of people there, including Gwendolyn Rollins, who lives in a public housing high-rise building, who tells, I mean, one of the most disturbing stories about something that happened where she lives.
Right. So she's on St. Thomas. I visited both islands, and St. Thomas was first hit by Irma on September 6th. Just incredibly powerful winds. And the Tutu high-rise housing project was designed with windows, a wall of windows on the front and on the back. And Hurricane Irma blew those windows right out. Mm. And in fact, a young woman who was only just 38 was blown out by the storm and sort of tossed to her death.
Just terrible. Another woman realized that people, and this is a problem across the Caribbean, people suffering diabetes couldn't keep their insulin cool, so that's what she's doing?
You're right. Immediately after the storm, there's a young woman named Imani Daniel, and her grandmother asked her to check on a friend who was in a nursing home. And she went to visit her and realized that that woman and the people around her were diabetics, had no way of keeping their insulin cold because, of course, there's no power. And so she began finding ice every day and taking it to all of these diabetics, dozens of them around the island.
We've spoken to the governor there, Kenneth Mapp, several times. There are concerns about whether USVI is going to get the money the governor says is needed to recover. President Trump is expected to sign a $36.5 billion disaster aid bill that would also include millions in low-interest loans. But is there a concern that people are leaving? You know, they can't get the medical care they need. They have nowhere to live. And that undermines the territory's recovery.
Yes, there is a concern. I think that there is a feeling that the Virgin Islands won't be the Virgin Islands if too many people who are from there and make up the place and the culture leave. But I do think that the sense from local authorities is that they are going to get assistance. In fact, they're coming up seeking more assistance this week. There is now a request for $7 billion in recovery money beyond the low-interest loans that you just talked about, and that is what's going to drive the economic recovery of the territory, which had been in pretty deep financial troubles even before the storms. What the governor has said to me is that he's hoping that for the next 3 to 5 years, all of that spending will be the main economic driver for the territory.
Look, you mentioned the financial problems of the Virgin Islands. The government owes more than $2 billion to bondholders and creditors. What can fix that? Why is there so much debt?
Well, one of the issues is that a large oil refinery on St. Croix shut down in 2012. It was the single largest private employer, and they need to find other folks who are willing to invest in the Virgin Islands and diversify the economy. There are also questions about how well funding has been managed. But again, people are hoping that maybe there's a silver lining in these storms because of all the revenue.
Right, that might come. Also, maybe smart rebuilding, you know, putting electricity lines underground, for instance.
Well, that's one of the things that's a big issue. And when I was down there, a bipartisan delegation visited for the first time. There is a federal law that says that basically after disasters, you rebuild to the standard that was there. And there's increasing talk among Democrats and Republicans alike to change that and actually build to a 21st century standard, because their argument is this is just a waste of taxpayer money, hurricane after hurricane, rebuilding the same way you always have.
That's Frederica Skouten, who grew up in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, traveled there to see the impact of the hurricanes. We'll post her articles at hearandnow.org. Frederica, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
One of the rising stars of the Democratic Party, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, announced a couple weeks ago that he will not run for governor of California next year. A strange announcement, perhaps, given that Garcetti was reelected this year with 81% of the vote. The announcement fueled speculation that Garcetti might have a different job in mind, president of the United States. Eric Garcetti joins us now from Los Angeles. Mayor, welcome back.
Wonderful to be back. Thanks for having me.
And let me ask you first why you decided not to run for governor of California.
You know, I think people always assume that politicians, we're just going to run for whatever's next. But I take seriously my job right now, and the two things I love the most in the world, my family and my city, are both here in Los Angeles. I just got sworn in on July 1st, and I felt like my work is undone, and I've got an amazing job here in the biggest city and the biggest state in America, overseeing the biggest port that we have, the busiest airport of origination and destination, greening our utilities, building jobs, preparing for the Olympics. Why walk away from something good when you have it right there?
So you will serve out your full term as mayor, you think?
No, you know, I have a supersized second term. We're changing our election date out here. So instead of 4 years, it's 5.5 years. So I never predict the future and I never make those sorts of commitments, but not because I have some sort of secret plan. My only plan right now is to dig into the traffic, to the homelessness, to the job creation, anti-poverty problems, the environmental work that we're doing right here, and also helping mayors around the country really highlight and connect with that work, because I think we all feel very powerless nationally right now when I want to remind people how powerful we are in our own local communities.
Well, a lot of people think that the reason that you're not running for governor, as you know, is because they believe you want to run for president in 2020. Do you have any interest in that?
I'll let others speculate on that. I assure you I'm really 100% focused on my job here. And it's not new that I've been traveling the country, although I'm doing it with new vigor, because I think increasingly we have to find those solutions in other communities. I was, just in South Bend, Indiana. My wife's from Indiana, so I travel there frequently. And I spent time there with, 5 different mayors in their offices, CEOs and others, looking at solutions. So, of course it matters who runs this country, but that's not what I'm focused on. I'm not a candidate for president right now. I'm a mayor of a great city, and I want to do that work first and foremost.
How do you feel as a Democrat right now? There was a sketch the other night on Saturday Night Live that portrayed the Democratic leadership of the moment, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Dianne Feinstein, as old and out of touch.
You love our fresh new ideas delivered by fresh new faces like me, Nancy Pelosi.
And me, Dianne Feinstein.
And me, Chuck Schumer.
Well, the sketch was hilarious, but, there's some shades of truth and probably some shades that are completely unfair. We've got an amazing team of some talented people that are working out there on really important issues, infrastructure. Dianne Feinstein, my senator, has done incredible work on the environment. She's working right now on gun control after the Las Vegas shootings and has done amazing work like the torture report. But I also do think that the Democratic Party in general, I've said, needs to be less obsessed with itself and more obsessed with American people. I don't care who the leader of the party is, even though Tom Perez is a good friend, because I think that, most Americans don't wake up asking, hey, who leads the Republican Party? Who leads the Democratic Party? What they wake up concerned about is their debt or their house payments or their education opportunities. We need to make sure there's a lot of voices in this discussion, and don't think about ourselves just as Democrats. Think of ourselves as people who are leaders focused on an American agenda rather than a Democratic agenda, and I think we'll do well.
One of the voices in the discussion right now, and he's been all over TV with his ads, is the Democratic billionaire Tom Steyer, who is calling for the impeachment of President Trump.
I'm Tom Steyer, and like you, I'm a citizen who knows it's up to us to do something. It's why I'm funding this effort to raise our voices together and demand that elected officials take a stand on impeachment.
Do you believe that President Trump should be impeached?
Well, I would have to look at evidence. There's a lot of very troubling things that we've seen out of this administration, absolutely during the campaign, interactions that he had with or his representatives had with Russian officials. Those things are incredibly corrosive to and troubling about our democracy. But it is not the only thing going on in our country. I think we have to get to the truth of that. And if that evidence leads to impeachment, of course, that's something that has to be on the table. But it's just as important to think about who's going to be in the House, think about what they represent, and become a party that is about what we give to Americans rather than, as I see the Republicans right now, defining themselves by what they take away, taking away our health care, taking away our immigration status, taking away our environmental protections, taking away our educational opportunities. I think we're better than that. So while we have folks like Tom, who's a friend too, who are focused very much on getting to the truth, and that is necessary, we also have to move the country forward. We can't just play defense.
How do you do that as a Democrat? What should the party be running on in 2018?
I do it every day here, and I do it with Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. We passed the largest infrastructure initiative in the nation's history the same night that Donald Trump was elected out here in Los Angeles. It's actually double the next biggest infrastructure initiative ever put before local voters. That's $120 billion. And if you look at another six or seven cities around the country, that same night that everybody focuses on so obsessively, we passed $230 billion of infrastructure. That's a quarter of what Washington, D.C. is talking about doing over 10 years, and we passed it in a single night. When President Trump withdrew from the Paris Climate Accords, another great example, I chair something called Climate Mayors. And instead of crying in a corner, I got on the phone and started talking to my fellow mayors and saying, why don't we pledge to implement the Paris Climate Accords? And we have now 383 cities that I've gotten on board, representing about 70 million Americans in 44 states. So, you know, we've got to just continue showing that we know how to get things done.
But on the issue of infrastructure, don't you feel like it's less likely now that there is going to be some big infrastructure plan from Washington? This is something that President Trump had said he supported. A lot of Democrats, obviously, in favor of infrastructure investment, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, the pace is very disappointing. This should have been the first thing that Congress and the administration did instead of, you know, unfortunately having to fight over health care, a tax cut. In fact, that money from the repatriation of corporate profits that are overseas really was, by a bipartisan consensus a couple years ago, going to go into rebuilding America, rebuilding our roads instead of, you know, a tax break for corporations that are making record amount of money. So I'm always an optimist. I always believe that there is a room and a deal, and most importantly, not because just mayors are calling for it, Americans are calling for it.
What do you think of the Republican tax plan, the tax cuts?
I'm troubled by the Republican tax cut. I don't quite understand right now, when we have corporations making record profits, why we're looking to give them further tax breaks, as well as folks at the top of the economic scale who now have more wealth than any time in the last 100 years. You know, tax cuts that actually go to working class and middle class people, I'm not opposed to, but if that's at the cost of a soaring deficit, this is not only illogical, it's immoral. They're talking about doing this with $1.5 trillion in cuts of Medicaid and Medicare. That just seems wrong at a moment when we should be expanding opportunities for people. So the second thing that troubles me greatly is the loss of some of the most important deductions for the middle class. And in states like mine, where we have the local and state tax deduction, to eliminate that is essentially telling donor states like mine, we're not only going to take extra dollars from you, but on top of that, you can't deduct that money, and that seems immoral.
You visited Asia in 2014 on a trade mission. You went to Japan and South Korea and China, big trading partners with Los Angeles. What do you think of President Trump's trip to Asia?
You know, I think that President Trump's trip to Asia was a dream for those folks who would like to replace American leadership. I think it was full of tantrums. It was full of rhetoric that sometimes sounded good. But at the end of the day, it reflected a very, very weak America. It's not the America that I know. An America that is strong is engaged. An America that is strong keeps its words to itself and lets its actions speak more loudly. It doesn't let other countries come together in trade pacts and then another one completely be able to write us off. He talks a tough game, but I haven't seen any actions. I just see weakness over and over again. It wasn't America first. It felt like it was dictators first on this trip.
What are you talking about specifically there? Why do you say that it showed weakness?
You know, for instance, you know, just taking Putin's word on the elections, or that China, you know, which is very much active in the world, engaged in places like Africa in the way that the United States used to be, is really replacing some of our global leaderships. We're backing away from those values that informed us, like human rights in the Philippines. We're backing away from the way that we used to engage with our closest allies in Japan and South Korea. And most of all, we're inconsistent. We have kind of Twitter tantrums instead of well-thought-out policies. We're seeing a divide between our own intelligence services and our commander-in-chief. Those things are very corrosive to power. From America has always been a combination of our hard power, our military and economic might, and the soft power that people want to be like us. And I think fewer and fewer of our friends today want to be like us, and we need to restore that.
Mayor Garcetti, I want to ask you one more question. And again, we understand you're not running for president right now, but just in case you do at some point, you're a former Navy.
I'll announce it on NPR first.
That's right. You can come right here and do it. We'll be happy to have you back. You're a former Navy Intelligence Reserve officer. Do you think that it is time to end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, the engagement in Iraq, I think we need to continue having some, you know, presence there. I think that's very important. The war formally is over. In Afghanistan, I do think we need a better thought out exit strategy. We need to make sure that the Afghanis and that the region can take care of itself, or else this is really going to be a war with no end in sight. If you look at Afghani history in Afghanistan, it will be, you know, decades, if not a century more, of fighting. And I think that the United States often feels like we on our own can solve these problems. I have tremendous, tremendous love and admiration for my fellow service members that are over there, and I think they're doing an extraordinary job. But for them and for this nation, I do think that we will need to have an exit strategy in the next couple of years. President Obama attempted that. Now we're kind of re-upping, and I'd hate to see that creep become what is already the longest war in our history become even longer.
That's Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles. Mayor, thanks as always for joining us.
Great to be with you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
How's your blood pressure? Maybe not as good as you think. I just took off my cuff. We've all been taking our blood pressure because the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology just changed the guidelines. Once high blood pressure was considered 140 over 80 and above, they've lowered it now to 130 over 80. Dr. Paul Welton is lead author on the study. He joins us from the American Heart Association's Scientific Sessions Conference in Anaheim, California. Doctor, why the shift?
We wanted to do a better job in getting the message to adults and the American public. When you get to the pressures 130 to 139, the top one, the systolic, or the bottom one, 80 to 89, the diastolic, you're already at double the risk for a heart attack or a stroke compared to those with normal pressure. We've always said, you know, less than 120 and less than 80 would be normal. And now we have better information from trials that can empower, really, adults to improve their health.
Right, because high blood pressure is second only to smoking as a preventable cause of heart attacks and strokes. You can prevent it. Exercise, good diet, but what about drugs? What are you saying? If somebody was in the, you know, 139 range and they thought, shoo, I'm just under the 140, right, but now they're over the 130. What should somebody do? Because there are drugs.
If you've had a heart attack or a stroke, obviously you're at high risk for another one. But if you haven't, we recommend using a calculator to determine your risk. If you're otherwise at low risk and just have high pressures in that 130, 139 range, then we strongly encourage lifestyle change, but not the use of drugs. There'll be about 30% in that range who are likely to have a high cardiovascular risk.
Yeah. What if somebody's really high? We got this cuff this morning. You can just get them at, you know, a drugstore. We've been passing it around. First of all, you probably shouldn't take your blood pressure when you're at work because it's higher. But some people had frighteningly high measurements.
Right. So blood pressure does fluctuate a lot, and so a single measurement isn't that valuable. So it's a team activity, and the patient is very valuable in terms of getting out-of-office blood pressures.
Yeah. Well, and also we want to remind people, if they say, I'm going to take the easy way out and just get some medications, they have side effects. They can be bad, for instance, for your kidneys. So you want to try to do it through reducing stress and diet and exercise first.
That's the first approach, always. And then we supplement it with medication. And then the medications are indeed very safe, but only should be used when they are needed.
This has been shocking to people. Were you aware that that would happen, that this would be a bit of a bombshell?
Yes. Well, you know, I'm old enough to know that we started thinking you didn't have to treat high blood pressure at all in older adults. We now know that was very silly. And we've progressively realized that this is a graduated risk. The lower the pressure is, the better. And as you go up the scale, you just get to progressively higher risk. And it's hard to close the barn door. So it's always better to try to keep your pressure as low as you can. And we really wanted to alert and to empower the adults in the U.S. as to what they can do to stay healthy.
Yeah, do it now. It's harder to do it later.
Exactly.
Dr. Paul Welton, clinical professor at Tulane University and the Sho Shuan Health System Endowed Chair in Global Public Health. Doctor, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin. Nice to chat with you.
You too. And we'll have more about the new guidelines at herenow.org. And again, do not take your blood pressure at work. It will not end well. About 800,000 young immigrants are still looking to Congress for clues to their future. Remember back in September, President Trump said he was ending the Obama-era program known as DACA, which gives young people brought to this country within a certain time frame permission to live and work here. This month, a group of House Republicans said they're ready to pass a law that would allow them to stay. But as Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports, a permanent solution from Congress would do something else. It would protect investments worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Investments like this one in the Logan Square neighborhood of Chicago.
It's my dad, Manito.
Hi. Hello, Manito. Mucho gusto.
28-year-old community organizer Laura Mendoza is at home in the three-bedroom house where she lives with her parents.
And then we have, like, the kitchen, which is a little bit smaller. My dad just cooked. He made some egg with, like, really spicy sauce, if you can smell it.
I can. It smells good.
It smells really spicy.
So, three bedrooms. How many square feet here?
Ooh, that is a good question that I don't know.
You don't know how many square feet are in your house?
No, absolutely not. I always have to look that up whenever we've had any work kind of done.
It doesn't matter because you have enough space.
Yeah, oh yeah, more than enough.
The house is modest, but it's hers. Laura and her older brother Christian bought it 2 years ago for about $400,000. There's a small desk in one corner of the living room.
That's kind of where I work. I have a little bit, half of like an ofrenda still up from Dia de los Muertos.
A tribute to our ancestors back in Mexico.
So it's just like a little altar. We still have a little bit of pan de muertos, which is a traditional bread that you eat during Day of the Dead. I really enjoy it, considering that I last saw my grandparents when I was like 6-7 years old. That's when we came. So it's just like kind of good to revisit all those memories.
Laura and Christian have come a long way from the Arizona border, where they crossed into this country illegally with their mother in the 1990s. They reunited with their father, who had already crossed and was working in Chicago. The siblings are just two of an estimated 123,000 so-called dreamers who've bought their own home since DACA began 5 years ago. Christian is 30 and a dietitian. He's been saving for this place since high school.
I didn't really have any responsibilities back then. I wasn't paying for any food or rent or anything like that. So I was able to put away some money, and it was for the purpose of buying a house.
You were working towards the epitome of the American dream at that point.
Sure.
And did you even have DACA at that point? I mean, that was before the program started.
That was way before. I mean, that was, like I said, however old you are in high school, 15, 14.
Did your status at that time ever make you think that you wouldn't be able to buy a house?
No, never. I think, as a child and teenager even then, you don't really understand what that means, a status. I didn't really understand what a status was. I just knew we were here illegally, but I didn't understand what it all meant, you know, if we were going to have limitations or anything like that. I think it's when you start getting older that you start to realize the limitations that come with it and, you know, the kind of hurdles that you have to jump to get to where you want to be.
Did getting DACA make it easier for you?
Absolutely. I mean, it made it 100 times easier.
Easier because he had permission to work and permission to drive, which means he could get a better job and earn enough money to make the $20,000 down payment. Still, Laura Mendoza says the bank was skeptical, even though they were upfront with their DACA status.
I think now I realize that they really didn't understand what the status was and like what it really meant. So we actually went through one lender. We got pre-qualified. As we were getting closer to the closing date, things with our status kind of starting resurfacing. So the lender was asking more about our status. And that's when they told us we actually don't lend to people with DACA.
Did they tell you why? I mean, did they say, look, we're not going to give you a loan for a term of 30 years if we don't even know if you're going to be in the country in the next 2 years. I mean, did they tell you why?
No, they didn't use those specific words. I think they just, like my sister said, they were unaware of what DACA meant. And they just said that they needed somebody who was a legal resident in order for them to give us the loan.
Now, there are plenty of banks that do make loans to Dreamers, but the ones I asked for an interview said no. They didn't want to get involved with the politics of immigration. A spokesperson for U.S. Bank told me their underwriters require a visa or a green card to get a loan. But across town, I did meet the person who helped the Mendozas line up financing.
I'm Kristen Kamara. I am the Vice President of Financial Wellness for the Resurrection Project, and we're here in the Pilsen community of Chicago.
Illinois is home to the third largest Dreamer population in the country, and the culture of immigrants is on full display in Pilsen.
It's one of the most vibrant Mexican communities in Chicago, and I think continues to be a place of Mexican culture.
And you can see it on the streets, right? I mean, there's like little bodegas and there's, you know, Mexican restaurants.
Yeah,
sort of
no, it's great. 18th Street is the main thoroughfare, and it is filled with Mexican restaurants and little shops.
And you've put a lot of immigrant families into housing in this very neighborhood over the years.
Absolutely. Every year we help between 100 and 200 families buy a home across the city of Chicago in immigrant communities in the Southwest Side.
All right, well, I want to talk about that, but it's November in Chicago, so let's go inside.
When we're out of the cold, Kamara tells me it can be difficult at first for some of her clients to qualify.
You know, I see a lot of young people with DACA who just aren't necessarily learning about banking and saving and debt from their parents. And so they have to learn that somewhere else.
So they come here. And Kamara says demand for the group's housing counselors is still strong despite DACA's uncertain future.
I was checking in with some of my staff earlier today, and they're saying that they're not seeing a difference in the interest of people stepping forward and saying, I want to buy a home. We have a continued steady pipeline of people with DACA who are in home purchase counseling, so kind of fixing their credit and saving. We have people who are looking for a home right now with a realtor. And we have recent closings as recently as the last week or two of new DACA homeowners. So I don't know. I think we're seeing people continue to say, I'm here in the States and I want to put down my roots.
Well, that's good. But are you telling your clients at all to prepare? Are you telling them, look, if you have to leave this house, you got to figure out what to do with it?
Yes. No, that's absolutely right. We're doing that throughout this entire course of the year. We're telling people that, yes, they should be making a plan. In the case that they are detained or deported, it is important to take complete inventory of your financial profile and have a plan in case something were to happen.
And Laura Mendoza is helping spread that message. She started working at the Resurrection Project after she bought her house. And back in her living room, I learned there's more than just a mortgage on the line.
Hey, Tom. Coming in.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Are you Tom?
Yes.
The Mendoza's tenant, Tom Rogus, came by to say hello after work. He and his wife rent the unit upstairs.
We moved in 19 months. I counted it the other day. 19 months ago.
So you've got to know the place, and you've probably got to know these guys, it seems like, a little bit.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you know they were DACA recipients?
I did not, no. I knew that they were Mexican from our conversation and from my excellent but difficult conversations with Mr. and Mrs. Mendoza.
And that means even for an American citizen, the future of DACA suddenly hits close to home. As for Christian, he says losing it would unravel everything his family has worked for.
without the job, I would be struggling to pay the mortgage. It's not like we have millions of dollars in the bank. Like, I'm paying mortgage month by month. And
what's that payment?
It is almost $3,000.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the last resort for you would be selling the house.
Yeah, I would probably think the last resort would be to try to sell the house.
One question I do have is, by definition, DACA is temporary. I mean, you have to renew it every 2 years. What would you say to somebody who said, well, why did you get yourself wrapped up in a mortgage if you knew the program was temporary in the first place?
It's the same thing. Like, I'm willing to take a risk, right? Because the reward is so much greater than not taking the risk. I mean, I could have not bought the house, but we would still be renting and, you know, concerned about that situation. And I'd rather have, you know, that control in my hands, if only for a little bit, right? Like, these 2 years, I mean, this has been my parents' home, and I'm not concerned that somebody's going to kick them out. That reward is worth taking the risk.
The risk will crystallize if Congress fails to act. The Mendoza's permission to work expires in 2019, and their options are running out. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd, reporting from Chicago.
It's been a little more than a year since President Trump won the White House, and hundreds of posts in the administration remain unfilled. Of the 600 key positions requiring Senate confirmation, more than 250 have no nomination at all. And there are plenty of other positions that don't require Senate approval that also remain vacant, including in the area of science and technology. For a closer look at that, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Tony Rahm is senior editor of policy and politics at Recode. He joins us. Hi, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, what are the key science and tech positions that don't have any nomination at all, and how important are they?
Yeah, you said there are about 200 of those positions throughout government that have no nominees. And when it comes to science and technology, there are about a dozen of them for which the president hasn't put forward any names. And they span positions in government that touch on everything from nanotechnology to cybersecurity to privacy and even to regulation of some of Silicon Valley's biggest companies like Facebook, Google, and Twitter. And when you talk to folks in the tech industry, they say that the absences have slowed down this administration's work on top science and technology issues, and it's ultimately resulted in little oversight of Silicon Valley as well.
But President Trump has said that he wasn't intending on making a lot of appointments because, as he put it in a Forbes interview, you don't need them. So should we be surprised that there are so many vacancies?
We shouldn't be surprised. I mean, there are two ways to cut government. One way is to slash it by spending less, and another is to simply not fill key roles in the White House and throughout the administration. But it's important to point out that with some of these positions, there's a requirement that they be filled. That includes the Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is basically the nerve center of the White House, so to speak. There, the president is supposed to maintain a top science advisor. It's written into law that he has to have that science advisor, but President Trump has put forward no such candidate, and as a result, his administration is lacking in some of that science expertise.
There are some positions where the delay is actually because of the Senate, like the heads of the Federal Trade Commission and the head of NASA. Who did President Trump nominate for those, and why is there a delay?
Yeah, with the Federal Trade Commission, or the FTC, the president has put forward three names: Joe Simons, who would be the Republican leader of the agency, Noah Phillips, another Republican, and Rohit Chopra, who's an ally of Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. But technically, President Trump has not sent those names in a formal way to the Senate, which is a rather wonky way of saying that the Senate can't start debate and ultimately have a vote on those nominees. Its hands are pretty much tied. And with NASA, it's a bit of a different story. Trump has put forward Congressman Jim Bridenstine from Oklahoma, a Republican, to lead the U.S. government's space agency. But a lot of lawmakers were very upset with his nomination, and they grilled him at a confirmation hearing just a few weeks ago. Their big concern was that Bridenstine's position on social issues and things like climate change would annoy a lot of NASA engineers and cause a lot of them to leave government for the private sector because they didn't share his controversial beliefs.
So, Tony, you're joining us from San Francisco. What is the relationship like at this point between Silicon Valley and the White House?
Yeah, I asked one of the Trump administration's few tech aides, Reed Cordish, this very question on stage yesterday at a conference here, and he stressed that, you know, the relationship is still fine, that they can walk and chew gum at the same time, that even though Silicon Valley often is critical of this administration, sometimes on issues like immigration or climate change and whatnot, that they can still work together on things like modernizing government, which is a thing that helps the U.S. government improve its relationship with citizens and also helps tech companies sell more of their goods to Washington, D.C. So the big message from the White House is that things may seem tense, but actually below the surface, they're working together on things.
Another big story in the world of tech I want to ask you about, which is that Bill Gates has reportedly invested $80 million into building a smart city outside of Phoenix. What do we know about this?
Yeah, it sort of sounds like a nerd Silicon Valley wonderland, so to speak. But Bill Gates and one of his investment firms has put forward money to create an ideal smart city outside of Phoenix, Arizona. And the thinking is that with this money, they can build from scratch a futuristic city where there are self-driving cars and ultra-fast, high-speed internet and, you know, city lights and other forms of infrastructure that can do things that maybe human beings were doing, maybe better law enforcement, maybe less pollution. They're really looking to try out a bunch of ideas that maybe would have been too difficult to do by taking a current city and, you know, investing millions of dollars there.
Is Bill Gates the only one in the tech world who wants to do something like this?
Certainly not. Google is another one. They have an entire outfit called Sidewalk Labs that is investing money towards figuring out a smart city, and they're doing their work in Toronto. But really, this is not an inevitable thing. The technology isn't there yet in some cases, like with self-driving cars, and Americans' attitudes are another matter entirely. Maybe Americans aren't necessarily ready for this kind of smart city, but the goal of these experiments, whether it's Bill Gates or somebody else, is to begin testing that out.
All I can think of is the Truman Show. I guess if they start putting cameras in these smart cities. It just sounds a little too planned, but we'll see what happens. Tony Rahm, senior editor of Policy and Politics at Recode. Thanks, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service and broadcasting from a smart city, but not that kind.
Okay.
In Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.